This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
TV's Japanism exhibition, Japan and the Birth of Modern Arts. Hello.
Hello.
Hello and welcome.
Thank you.
As I said to you as we walked in, I can't believe I haven't met you because we're over the years we've interviewed so many people from the NGV that it's surprising that we haven't met you yet.
It's a bit strange. I've been there for about 12 years.
Right. So, is that all? Yeah. You're one of the young ones.
Yeah. David hangs around there. Jay-Z's got nothing to do, so you've probably kicked him out at some point.
Yeah. give us your story. How did you get to be at the NGV?
Oh, it's actually...
The love of art?
But I have to say, actually, I didn't start out working in art history. I had a background in archaeology.
Oh, okay. What sort? Is it a particular style that you're working within or interested in?
Yeah, it was the actual, excavation work, field work that I did was mainly late antique and Byzantine period material, a lot of it in Egypt. My doctoral work was on, in fact, even stranger again, late antique synagogues in the Eastern Mediterranean.
And wow.
So the literature and the art and architecture of the synagogues. So, I always had an interest in art history, and that just gradually became stronger and stronger. And I went and did some more study, specialist study in art history.
Okay.
And
let's go back to the synagogues because they are... they're just extraordinary, aren't they? To walk into them, and with all the art on the walls, painted onto the walls, or the incredible lighting hanging,
certainly from antiquity, the extraordinary mosaics that survive. They're it's very interesting because there is that old idea that, Judaism was an iconic religion that didn't use images, didn't embrace an art tradition. But in fact, it couldn't be further from the truth. Mm. The Dura Europos Synagogue is extraordinary and important, painted fresco cycles, and then the incredible mosaics that survive in a lot of, synagogue remains in modern Syria and Israel. Mm. Testament to a very vivid and vibrant artistic tradition.
Yeah. So why did you move away? You just mentioned that you did other studies. Why were you starting to move away from all of that?
It's really embarrassing to admit it, but I have to say that I decided that archaeological field work really was not for me. It's more like roadworks than anything else, and I'm not really a shovel and trowel kind of guy, actually, in the end.
I wouldn't want to be either.
I was thinking of the heat when you said a lot of it in Egypt. Wouldn't it be very hot?
Well, some of the places, in the Western Desert in Egypt where I worked, I remember, being outside one day. We had a little LCD thermometer with us, which stopped when it clocked 48 degrees Celsius.
Whoa.
Because the LCD display actually melted in the heat.
Oh.
And it was still going up. So we were, but it was a bit the stupid white people who were out.
The
sun at midday.
As Noel Coward said,
mad dogs and Englishmen. Exactly,
So you did extra study to get yourself away from there.
Quieter
and cleaner. And what was the big light bulb moment where you thought, okay, this is where I'm going now?
In terms of my actual formal art historical studies, I'm actually an 18th century specialist, and particularly as a decorative arts curator, in fact, ceramic and ceramic history is something that is of enormous interest to me. And so
NGV has a lot of ceramic.
Yeah, and I actually particularly became fascinated by porcelain, which, can sort of sound a little bit, porcelain figures and things like that you sort of associate with the kitsch things on your grandmother's mantelpiece and things
like
that.
What about that amazing artist here in Melbourne, which I know she does a bit of restoration for you, Penny?
Penny Byrne, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And those crazy reimaginings and politicising those kitsch early 20th century figures. Yeah, fantastic work. But, you know, porcelain was one of the major, it's an enormous, you know, scientific, technical and cultural achievement in the 18th century in Europe when, you know, of course, China and Japan had mastered porcelain technology centuries ago. But, you know, 1708, when it happens in Saxony, in Dresden, the discovery of a true porcelain formula, it's an absolute, you know, it's a major scientific achievement, but has incredible cultural ramifications as well.
Right.
You know, the medium throughout the 18th century has important political resonances. You know, it costs an awful lot of money to run a porcelain factory, so one had to be a very wealthy and powerful prince to actually have one. And so the material itself, you know, becomes an important political tool. Porcelain objects are traded as diplomatic gifts. They're statements of, you know, power and prestige on the part of the people who made them. So there's this really fascinating, you know, cultural history to the material, which when you're aware of that, affects then how you look at the objects. You know, a dinner service becomes more than a dinner service when you realise to actually produce a dinner service of, you know, 300 pieces so that you and, you know, 68 of your closest friends can sit down and have dinner in very grand fashion together.
Yeah. Or Catherine the Great.
Yeah, yes. The huge service she ordered from Sev, the largest that Sev ever produced and the most expensive. It took the Russian state 30 years to pay the bill for that. I mean, you know, these things are statements of power and of, you know, the control of economic resources, of labour resources. There's a really fascinating, you know, deep cultural significance to what can just seem now to us, where we use porcelain every day in our lives. You know, we don't just eat off it, we go to the toilet on it. You know, it's lost some of that enchantment, but it was this extraordinary material.
And isn't that the wonderful thing about history, is how you learn what we take for granted. It's just fascinating. We could go into a whole new... All right, so 12 years ago, you joined the NGV.
Yes.
That would have been a major milestone in itself, say, digging in ditches, you know, like working at this place now is becoming so famous around the world.
Yeah, I sort of, you know, have to remind myself, you know, every so often, it's actually an extraordinary privilege to work with the collection that the permanent collection of the NGV is extraordinary. And it's, you know, sometimes it's easy for us to forget that. There are all sorts of amazing artworks across, you know, all sorts of fields, media, and a huge historical span represented in the collection as well, from Mediterranean antiquities through to contemporary art. Yeah, just to have the opportunity. It's a great, you know, it's a great privilege to have such a great set of toys to play with.
Interesting toys. Now, the Japanese are so well known for their incredible art, and what when it was discovered in the world, you know, like so many famous artists would, you know, like, refer to Japanese art in their paintings, in the background or whatever, but the Japanese then opening their door to accept art from around the world was and that's what this exhibition's about, isn't it?
Well, the exhibition, Japanism, Japan, and the birth of modern art is actually, it's looking at Japanism is the term for this phenomenon in European art and design in the second half of the 19th century, where after 1853, the American Commodore Matthew Perry sails into Tokyo Harbour, a flotilla of four ships, and he's bearing, you know, a message from the President of the United States offering the United States friendship to the Japanese government, and also the desire to trade with Japan, open up trade. Because, of course, at that point, Japan had been in a state of self-imposed isolation for 220 years. Their borders were closed. They didn't allow foreigners to step foot on Japanese soil, with some very few exceptions. And Japanese were not allowed to leave Japan either. So it was very much a closed society.
Sort of almost a communist state, but not once without being able to leave or anyone coming in.
But you had
freedom within the country, though. Yeah.
Well, as free as a, you know, feudal society where you have, you know, peasants who are, you know, a large, relatively poor population and a small, wealthy aristocratic class ruling them. But, of course, the Japanese government was very torn about this offer of trade, but, you know, the important point to make is that the flotilla, the small squadron of ships that Matthew Perry arrived in, was they were in fact military vessels, and just to make the point that, you know, the Americans meant business when they were asking for trade relations to be opened, they shelled a few buildings around Tokyo Harbour just to demonstrate what modern Western technology was capable of.
So right.
it was very much a case of Japan was forced to open herself to trade with the West. Now, that triggered, of course, the beginnings of a whole process of profound change within Japan itself. The Japanese state very quickly realised that if they were not to suffer the same fate as China, be subjected to colonial occupation, they had to very quickly modernise and yep. westernise. And so that began the whole the process of, you know, technological and military advancement on Western models in the Japanese context. But from the European perspective, what this opening of trade meant was, for the first time in 220 years, effectively for the first time ever in anyone's memory, Japanese artwork and Japanese craft was beginning to arrive in Europe in significant quantities. And it was absolutely revolutionary. Here was a visual language, a design language, which was totally different to the classical academic artistic tradition which held sway in Europe and America at that time. And it arrives at a point in time, the mid-19th century, when there is a great deal of concern in the West, in particularly cultural politics of the West, that, you know, the Industrial Revolution has led to social problems in, you know, urban centres. There's growing urban poverty, people that are being made unemployed by the growth of industry, the destruction of traditional crafts and trades, but also that the objects that are being made by these new industries are poorly designed, they're ugly, that's seen as a big problem. So there is a real interest in Europe at this period in design reform, in improving design, artists becoming involved with industry to actually produce, you know, objects for consumption that are not only functional but beautiful. And then Japanese art suddenly appears on the scene as these debates are going on across Europe. So here is this brand new visual language. It's immediately inspirational for artists and designers. But also, from a Western perspective, Westerners believed that Japanese art and craft didn't draw that traditional distinction between the high arts in the West of, say, sculpture and painting, and then the lesser arts, the crafts, ceramic making, glass making, metal work. From the Western perspective, Japan, the Japanese, treated all of this material as art. So that was a revolutionary idea for Western artists and designers. And, of course, you know, it meshes very nicely, conveniently, with the arts and crafts movement, which is going on, you know, origins in Britain, but is quickly spreading to the German-speaking world and places like that. But, you know, so what Japanese art presented to Western viewers was a completely different way of, you know, constructing a picture, for example, no single point perspective, you know, something that had dominated Western artistic tradition since the Renaissance. A decorative, you know, that pictures could have a decorative effect, the use of blocks of colour, ornamental characteristics in a picture. New subject matter, new motifs, new subjects that, you know, artists could look at using. And, of course, it all came from a Western perspective. There's no freight of historical or symbolic significance that anything out of the Western historic tradition brought. This was something that Westerners appreciated purely at a visual level. They didn't understand any of the Buddhist symbolism, the Shinto symbolism, any of the traditional Japanese meanings of what they were looking at. This was an art that they could appreciate purely from the perspective of, you know, visual beauty. So it was, you know, something clearly very exciting and very inspirational for artists and designers in the West. And it, you know, it's a virtual revolution. Art in the following sort of, you know, 30 years, Western art is totally transformed by this exposure to the Japanese tradition.
And what's the exhibition? Is that a little bit of all of what you've just mentioned?
Yeah, so the exhibition sort of traces an historical trajectory from the first Western encounters with Japanese art. So we've got a number of objects in the NGV's collections that actually came into the collections from the Melbourne 1880 and 1888 international exhibitions, because the international exhibitions around the globe were an important means by which, you know, Japanese material was disseminated to various countries and was not only put on display, so, you know, a Melbourne audience in 1880 could see Japanese art that had been sent by representatives of the Japanese government to Melbourne, but they could buy it as well. And the Japanese phenomenon, there was always an important commercial aspect to it. You know, the spread of Japanese art was through the sale of Japanese art. So we sort of start with that initial encounter, and what one sees there with the Western artworks that are responding to Japanese art is, to begin with, you know, kind of rather literal copying. You might, motifs are being lifted directly from Japanese works. So you'll find pictures, or you'll find, you know, ceramic works or glass works with, you know, classic Japanese motifs, images of geisha, parasols, chrysanthemums, all of that sort of exotic imagery. And then the exhibition traces a development of a gradual abandonment of this literal copying of the surface qualities of Japanese art, and instead kind of a deeper engagement with the underlying aesthetic principles that are informing Japanese art. And the end point of that trajectory is, and which is the last displays of the exhibition, is looking at Art Nouveau. So in the last decade of the 19th century, the first decade of the 20th century, this art movement, which, you know, is the first, it's the beginnings of modernism, it's the first modern art movement in the West, where objects don't at all look Japanese, you know, at first glance, but everything about them is informed by deep aesthetic and compositional principles that Western artists have absorbed from Japanese art and are now using to create something that is Western, brand new, and completely of its own time and place. And that's the beginnings of the modern.
Like, you can see it now. We're looking at an Art Nouveau piece, and it's very Japanese in its way. Fascinating, and you're a fascinating person. So many stories and so little time to. So this exhibition's on until late October.
28th of October, I think, yes.
And even though the NGV on St Kilda Road is a buzz right now with MoMA, you can escape the MoMA if you've already seen it and go off and check this one out.
Yes, and this one's free. The awesome. Exhibition's free. So,
and whereabouts is it?
It's on the first floor in the Asian Art Temporary Exhibition galleries.
Okay. Thank you so much, Matthew, for coming in today. And what's the exhibition called again?
Japanism, Japan and the Birth of Modern Art.
Okay, so look it up on the NGV's website to get more details about it. But thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to meet you.
You're on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.